This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting worldwide live to Europeans and Americans wherever they may live in the world, and certainly to all people of the world, because, as I always say, my philosophy, the ideas that I express on this program, I think are completely consistent, they're non-hypocritical. I believe that all people on this planet have a right to life, have a right to preserve their own traditions, their own values, even their own genotype, the unique stamp that makes them as they are. Everyone has that right to life, that right to liberty. I think every people has a right to control its own destiny and to have its own society, its own nation reflect its own traditions and own interests. That's the problem, you see, ladies and gentlemen. When we have nations with very strong and powerful minorities, inevitably there is conflict. Liberals may want to have this dream that we're all exactly the same. They may have this dream that they want to remake humanity into this faceless, I guess colorless or colorful uniformity. I think this dream is a nightmare, not a dream. In the first place, it's not achievable. The way races come about is through geographic separation over time. And even in societies that mix, a good example is the Yucatan Peninsula. There was a mixture between different Indian tribes and the Spanish conquistadors who conquered that region many, many centuries ago. And then over the ensuing centuries, different tribes grew up, and there became what you would call caste wars in Yucatan. So these varying tribes with varying mixtures separated themselves out, developed their own unique heritage, and they warred upon each other for centuries. In fact, there's a very fine book about it by that very same title, The Caste Wars of Yucatan. If you look at the greatest source of war and human misery and human conflict in the world, you'll find it is ethnic conflict. Sometimes it's also laced with religious conflict. When you combine both ethnic and religious, that's where you have the worst conflict. It is raging right now, for instance, in Paris, France. The riots that are going on in Paris were certainly unthinkable before the massive immigration that came into France over the last 40 or 50 years since the time of the Second World War, and accelerated, of course, during the last 20 to 30 years. In America, we see a tremendous amount of ethnic conflict coming. We see the same thing happening in Sweden. As you know, recently, this individual prosecutor in Sweden has told the police to reopen my case, that perhaps that I violated the law, some sort of law against harassment of an ethnic group, whatever that means. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe in freedom of speech. And if you listen to my speech, and it is available on davidduke.com, it's my Helsingborg speech. And of course, I made many speeches in the country, and I'm very happy for the authorities to listen to all of them, read all my books, and I'm sure there are authorities right now in Sweden listening to this broadcast. I hope they listen very carefully. And there's nothing I'll say in this broadcast that's any different than what I say any other time. And there's nothing hateful about what I'm saying. I do think the Swedish people should preserve their heritage. I think that all peoples should preserve their heritage. I think that's a basic human right. And I think the most fundamental of rights in terms of liberty and freedom is the right of freedom of speech. That's why our forefathers in the United States made the First Amendment, the First Amendment, the right of freedom of speech. Because freedom of speech conscience, expression, freedom of thought. That's the entire axis around which the entire wheel of the other freedoms that we have circulate. In fact, if you have terrible violations of human rights, let's say you have murder, or you have genocide, or you have torture, or you have any other sort of oppression of humanity, the only way that you can keep that down or stop a rebellion or stop people from, you know, fighting against this is by suppressing freedom of speech, suppressing knowledge, suppressing people's right to hear, suppressing people's right to debate these issues, to talk about these issues. And freedom of speech, by the way, of course, is never needed for popular ideas. A popular idea or an idea that's accepted by the establishment or the authorities never needs protection, right? Freedom of speech is only important and only vital when, by law anyway, when you have someone who's opposing the government, when you have a dissident. In Castro's Cuba, it's never been a problem down there if you praise Castro. But there has been a problem in Cuba if you condemn Castro. In the old Soviet Union, it was a big problem if you condemned communism or you condemned the leadership of the Communist Party. If you did that, you were a dissident, and you could very likely be jailed because there was no freedom of speech. And in the West, in Sweden and in Denmark and Germany and England and America, Canada, we always held our heads high. We still do. You still hear the expression of freedom of speech and freedom of thought and freedom of conscience being expressed all the time in all the Western countries. We held up high the idea that a man could express himself on any political matter any way that he chose without fear of imprisonment, without fear of retribution or torture or suffering or confiscation or any of the things that tyrannies do to suppress dissent. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sad to say that that's going by the wayside. All over the world, it's going by the wayside. In Sweden, apparently, they have these laws against so-called harassment. However you define that, that's a pretty interesting definition because it's one of those things that the authorities, the establishment, can define any way that they choose. And again, that's not freedom. The one thing that a law has to have, it has any sort of moral authority, is it's got to have a consistency. It's got to be equally applied. In America, we call it equal protection under the law. Well, it seems like my equal protection is not, it's at stake now in Sweden because the Swedish government, or at least a particular prosecutor in the Swedish government, is suggesting that the police reopen the case, and he's chomping at the bit to try me, whether in absentia or whether in Sweden, who knows, and hopefully sentence me 5 years in prison on each count of simply expressing an opinion that he doesn't like or he doesn't agree with, that's anti-establishment, that's a dissident opinion. And what's this opinion that I expressed? Well, you can hear it in my speech in Helsingborg. I said that the Swedish people have a right to maintain Sweden as such, that they have a right to maintain their heritage, that they should work to get control over their immigration and not have their country become non-Swedish, that they've got a right to preserve their traditions, their values, that Sweden is a beautiful country and a beautiful people with a beautiful and a magnificent heritage. And even the way that Swedish people look is something worthy of preservation, the same way that we would work to preserve any beautiful aspect or expression of nature in the animal kingdom. Certainly human beings, we're part of this great tapestry of nature. And the different expressions of human beings have a right to be preserved as any other kind of life on the planet. I talked in my speech, for instance, that, you know, you have many immigrants coming in to Sweden who literally are among a population that's hundreds of millions strong. The Swedes are only about 9 million. Doesn't this small population, this small country, doesn't this nation have a right to preserve its way of life, its traditions, its values, its very people? Should this nation be ethnically cleansed? Because that's what it really amounts to. When a people who were the majority, the founding creation, the creators of a society, when they become a minority in their own country and they become totally subject to an alien religion, value system, political process, and sometimes one that's animated by anger against the founding Swedes. And what happens to the rights of those Swedish people? What kind of a nation do those Swedish sovereign live in? And this is a question that's got to be answered, of course, as well on France and Germany and Austria and Italy and Spain, England, Ireland today, Canada, the United States of America. You know, do we really want our children to walk as strangers in our own country? And is this multiculturalism that we're reaching for and that our leaders are putting upon us? And that's why I guess we're dissidents, because we disagree with the policy of our respective governments. In fact, most people in every major nation of Europe disagree with the policies of our governments. We know that we want to preserve our way of life, and we're opposed to this immigration. Now, that apparently is hate speech. And if I talk about some of the negative aspects of this immigration, that also is hate speech, just by telling the truth. One of the things I talked about in the speech was the fact that for the first time ever, Sweden is now experiencing something, a terrible phenomenon, a horrendous phenomenon called gang rape, where 13 or 14 or 15 or 16-year-old girls are brutally beaten and raped. And gang rape is almost entirely, and this is the fact of the matter, there's no argument about this fact, it's almost entirely done by the immigrant population. This is one of the blessings, I guess, of diversity, one of the blessings of immigration, one of the blessings the media don't talk about very often. And gang rape, from being something that just literally never happened in Sweden, and that's sublime and God-fearing and beautiful, law-abiding nation. Now, gang rape is something that is quite common. It happens somewhere in Sweden almost every day. And this is something people wouldn't want for their children. And yet this is occurring. I talked about some Swedish children in public school inside Sweden itself who are now a tiny minority in their own schools. And they themselves feel like outsiders, like strangers in their own country. This isn't right, ladies and gentlemen. This is destructive. And this is against, I think, every kind of human rights every kind of human rights principle that we all revere in Western civilization. And many other people obviously revere around the world. Now, the other thing I talked about, I guess the ultimate taboo that I talked about in my speech in Helsingborg, as well as in my other speeches, and I always talk about it, it's probably my main subject in many ways because I think it's the world's foremost problem, is a phenomenon I call Jewish supremacism. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, you know, this is not a condemnation, obviously, of all Jews, but it's certainly a condemnation of an element among the Jews, an extremist element called Jewish supremacists, who are seek and have attained already not only domination over the Jewish people, and I think to their detriment, because I think it endangers the Jewish people and has resulted in a lot of the reactions to Jewish people over the years, but it also is a serious endangerment to the Gentile population. The extremists control Israel. Israel is a racial extremist state. Now, these same multiculturalists, these same people that push multiculturalism and open immigration for the United States, for Sweden, for England, for France, and all these other countries. This same liberal Jewish element, and I must tell you, this is not simply liberals among Europeans that are advancing this. This movement, you might say, from the Frankfurter School all the way down to Franz Boas anthropological basis, to the Lowentins and the Caymans and the Roses, and the Diamonds and the other advocates of multiculturalism and multiracialism, to the great mass integrators, the NAACP, which was started mainly by these same supremacist Jews and very few blacks. In fact, there was only one black in the founding order of the NAACP. And again, the NAACP is a lot different than black nationalist groups like Marcus Garvey led and other groups that talk about pride in the black people. I really believe, and what I've shown in my speeches and what I've shown in my work, my book Jewish Supremacism documents it, that while these same Jewish supremacists support a Jewish state, a state dedicated to Jewish people, a state where immigration is strictly limited to people who are Jewish, where they don't even allow marriage between a Jewish person and a non-Jewish person, where the Kohanim, which is they call the priest class, are their elite section of Jews. Those are primarily people with the Cohen last name or similar derivative of such. They're not even permitted to marry another Jew. That's right, a practicing religious Jew who has any taint of Gentile blood. Even if this practicing Jew has ancestry of Jews many generations back, if they have any Gentile blood, they're not allowed to marry that person. And that's not just in the Jewish religion, my friends. That's by order of the Jewish state, which is controlled by the Jewish religion. They have yeshivas in Israel, where they teach young Jews incredible acts of hatred against Gentiles. In fact, there's a common phenomenon going on right now in Israel. It's been reported by the Daily Telegraph in Britain and other papers, where Jewish students are spitting in the face of Christians, especially Christian priests and prelates. It's an incredible phenomenon. Israel Shahak talks about that. In fact, I talked about Israel Shahak in my speech. Here's a man who survived the concentration camps of the Second World War, the German concentration camps. But he was a very honorable Jewish individual, and he stood up against Jewish supremacism. And he was a very strong leader in the peace movement in Israel, a doctor of chemistry, a survivor of the Second World War. In fact, I dedicated my book to Israel Shahak. I think that kind of shows that I'm not against every Jew, that I'm not anti-Semitic, and I'm not preaching hatred against Jews, but I am certainly trying to expose this Jewish supremacist phenomena that exists and empowers a lot of these radicals all over the world and endangers us, because these same people are the ones that control our press and our media, and where you begin to have this incredible hypocrisy. People often ask me, well, what are you going to do, you know, with the Jews, or what do you do with the non-whites? Would you, you know, expel them? I think illegal aliens should be expelled, and I think that we should do what we can to work with these people and to help resettle them, you know, with economic incentives in their own societies. I don't think we're going to solve the problems of the world bringing them into our own countries. Well, you see how I'm talking here, and the way I'm speaking at this moment on this radio broadcast is the same way that you'll hear me on the speech and any other speeches you hear me make around the world. This is not hatred. This is legitimate political thought. You may disagree with it, but ladies and gentlemen, whether you agree or disagree, you know, I've got a right to speak my mind, my conscience, to express my opinions. I'm doing it in a sane and a decent way. And I'm not even advocating any suppression of anybody around the world. What I'm advocating is that our people simply begin to stand up for our heritage the way that other people certainly do, and the way the media in our respective nations, which is often controlled by the Jewish supremacists, the way they suggest these other peoples do. In fact, if you go to Sweden today, you can quite often read in the Swedish press or hear in the Swedish media stories of how minorities, both in Sweden and around the world, are standing up, trying to continue their traditions and how wonderful this is, and to advance their interests and their culture and preserve their language, all this kind of thing. You hear it every day in the media. But somehow, you see, in Sweden, it's fine for a minority to do that, and for a minority anywhere else in the world to do that, any sort of non-Swede, non-European. But if a Swede does it, then this is hate speech. Now, I don't like the prospect of possibly being locked up for 5 years, and there's even possibilities that Sweden could try to extradite me if they decided to prosecute me on these matters. The truth is, if they want to make an international incident out of this thing, I would probably go to Sweden and fight it and stand up. It'd probably be one of the biggest cases in that country and maybe in Europe, considering my background and my controversial nature, and it would expose the fact that Sweden is losing and Europe has lost freedom of speech, that no Swedish government official, if they tried to prosecute me for this kind of speech, that no British government official, no French official, no Canadian official could stand up and say, you know, we stand for freedom or we stand for human rights. You know, the most basic human right of all, again, is freedom of speech and freedom of conscience. It's funny how all that seems to evaporate in the March sun when someone starts standing up and disagrees with the philosophy of the establishment today. We have a new religion going on in our society today. It's called egalitarianism. And anyone who disagrees with that new religion is not simply wrong in the minds of the people who control our governments and our societies. They're not only wrong, but they're absolutely evil from their point of view, that they should be suppressed and stamped out like vermin. I mean, that's exactly what's going on here. We're heretics in the classical sense, and we deserve rack and tong or prison or whatever simply for expressing our viewpoints. Isn't that odd? At the same time, I've talked about also in my speech about how in Sweden today, they even had one Jewish lady who was literally showing pornography and playing pornographic tapes to school children, toddlers practically, to school children, try to get their reactions. This was supposed to be art, represented as art in Sweden. You know, pornography is permitted. That's part of freedom of speech, right? Freedom of conscience, the human right, tradition, no matter how degenerate. I mean, there is pornography in Sweden and all through Europe today and all over the world that is not illegal, not stopped, where women are completely degraded, and men as well. I mean, people defecating on each other. My God. I mean, I hate to even talk about something as vile as that, but that's the kind of society that we live in. That's perfectly okay. That's legal in our societies. But if you have a different opinion, and you can back it up with some reason and some thoughts and academically. I mean, I'm a PhD today, as you know. You know, I'm a doctor of philosophy and history. And yet somehow I'm not allowed to express my opinion politically. I'm not allowed to express my opinion about anthropology. I'm not allowed to express my opinion about history. I'm not allowed to express my opinion about current events. And then these countries call themselves free. I would also ask my new listeners of this program to begin to ask yourself some questions. I mean, what is it about, you know, my opinion that these people are so afraid of? If they're so sincerely convinced of the rightness of their cause, why are they afraid that I utter my opinion? Because if my opinion is so wrong, let's go out and debate it, let's discuss it, and you can show me, and you can show certainly all my listeners, the error of my ways. But obviously, I think they're afraid of their ability. You know, ladies and gentlemen, what truth needs prison to protect it? You know, what is it? You know, or could it be that what I say and people like myself, what we say has too much a ring of truth to it, that it makes too much sense, that it's too reasonable, even though it's not what the mass media preaches and what they teach and the kind of message? I think that the average Swede listening to this broadcast right now would agree with most of what I've said. Wouldn't disagree with it, you know. And you know, but you see, today you cannot criticize Jewish supremacism. You can criticize something called white supremacism. And by the way, I am not a white supremacist. You know, I am not trying to control the world. I don't think white people should be supreme over other peoples in the world. I think that we have our own nations, our own homelands, and they should reflect our values the best we can. We created those homelands, and we created our culture and heritage, and we have a right to preserve that. But I'm not a supremacist, you know. And I think even within those homelands where we have the presence of some minorities, we should let the minorities control their own environments, their own neighborhoods, their own schools, as much as possible, ladies and gentlemen. And we shouldn't force them together or try to make them assimilate or anything else. You know, I think that every people has a right to preserve its way of life. And I think that the best way to solve the problems of the earth in terms of the conflicts is to allow nations to be constructed in a natural way. And that's on the basis of ethnicity and religion, the natural groupings that mankind creates. Basically, if you put people in the same environment who are vastly different, you can again propagandize them all day long, but eventually you're going to have conflict. People tend to associate with their own kind, and people like themselves. That will happen no matter what government does. That will happen no matter what politics does, no matter what what education does. That's the reality of life. And instead of trying to fight against this reality and reaping the whirlwind because of it and the disaster that this kind of policy brings, we should recognize this simple part of human nature and try to accommodate it the best we can. And I think in the long run, by doing so, we are literally helping to to bring peace and human rights and decency to the earth. So ladies and gentlemen, that's what it's all about, and that's what I'm trying to do. And you know, if they try to put me in jail for 5 years or 10 years or whatever, you know, I guess somebody's got to risk jail in this world to tell the truth. The one thing, again, you can't talk about, and I guess you can talk somewhat about immigration, but the one thing you can't talk about, of course, in this world anymore is Jewish supremacism. And it really is a danger. This is not some helpless Jewish minority anymore. It's always depicted in the books, you know, and before the Second World War and the rest of it. We're talking about people of immense power. These Jewish supremacist neocons created, obviously, the war in Iraq. Any thinking person, any educated person that has any knowledge of the people who orchestrated this war knows this to be a fact. Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz were the two main architects of this war. Both of them are Jewish supremacists who've shown allegiance to Israel, dramatic allegiance to Israel, over the years. Wormser, Feith, Kristol. You know, these people form the engine of the neocon movement. The Jewish supremacists in media in the United States, of course, you know, cheerleaded this war. The most powerful lobby in the United States Congress today is AIPAC, which is a Jewish lobby, and they use hundreds of millions of dollars, and they have a tremendous political influence. They certainly pushed for this war, and I can document that again from their own sources. Congressman Moran was so courageous when he stood up before this war, and he said, you know, he talked to one of the Jewish questioners in one of his meetings in Virginia, and he said, okay, he said, you know, if the Jewish community would just, you know, not support this war and come down off of supporting this war, maybe we could find a peaceful solution and not have this disaster looming before us. And for that, of course, he was condemned. But it's a reality. Israel provided a lot of the false information, the lies of the weapons of mass destruction we use. Israel Cohen, Stuart Cohen, in the CIA was the guy who handled most of the intelligence. We have people like Scooter Libby, Lewis Libby, again, who right now is being charged as an aider and abettor in this false lying propaganda that tried to get us to go to war. You see, the American people were not going to enter this war with this tremendous cost of American life and this huge cost of American resources and money, and also the empowering of the terrorists that we've actually accomplished by this war. They weren't going to go to make these terrible sacrifices just for Jewish aggrandizement in the Middle East, for Israeli dominance in the Middle East, because Israel wanted to smash, and Ariel Sharon, by the way, the greatest mass murderer, terrorist, head of state in the world today. I mean, here's a guy who should be on the dock, if anybody ever should be on the dock for war crimes, it's Ariel Sharon. Even the Kahan Commission, the Israeli Commission, and the Israeli Commission himself cited him as responsible for the terrible massacre of 1,000 to 2,000 men, women, and children at Sabra and Shatila and Beirut. He's the butcher of Beirut. He's also been involved in many other war crimes. But he's the Israeli head of state. And he is head of a party in Israel. It's so extreme, it's amazing. Many people in the party, for instance, actually call for the absolute brutal expulsion of the Palestinians in Israel, even the murder of them. Even Ariel Sharon has waxed poetic about, if you can use that term, he waxed poetic about the fact that Israel, you know, should have killed these Palestinians and literally driven them all out. He said Israel would now be a nation of 25 million. This is quoted by Amos Oz, one of the top Israeli journalists. And I quote that in my book, Jewish Supremacism. That's why they're so afraid of my book, because I point out and show this element. Again, if you point out white supremacism or white racism, nobody accuses you of being hateful. If you point out any sort of racism against any other people, they don't say anything to you. But if you point out Jewish supremacism and Jewish racism, then you're in big trouble in the world today. Well, let's go to Stormfront. Again, you can send me an email at davidduke.com. It's info44 at davidduke.com. That's info44 at davidduke.com. And I'm very happy to get your emails. Also, of course, you can go to stormfront.org, the town hall section, and you're welcome to post there. And in fact, we've gone over, yesterday, we went over 1 million views. That's on the stormfront.org part of our program. 1 million views. 1 million Jews. I guess I have Jews in the mind. Here's an individual. This is from, let's see who it's from. Give me a name, people, not just your screen name or not just your email address. This is from DR. He says, "Hello, Dr. Duke. I recently received an assignment in English class to write a research paper on a controversial topic. My first thought was to write about the Middlebury Institute and Vermont's possible succession. Just a few moments ago, I was on your site and read the article that included your speech on the Iraq War being for Israel, in particular reference to the actions of our dear friend Scooter. I now decided to write on the possible reasons for the Iraq War with particular focus on the work of the Jewish supremacist neocons. I thought you may be pleased to hear this, but I also have another unrelated question to ask you. When you're discussing Jewish supremacism with someone not of your political ideology, how do you differentiate between Jewish supremacists and people who happen to be Jewish? In other words, how do you avoid sounding like a racist difference between racism and racialism noted? The reason I ask this is this. A friend of mine is a very liberal Jew, but the last thing she could possibly be is a supremacist. We discuss politics a lot. I'm well aware of her political views, but in her eyes, I am fairly enigmatic. The reason being that when we get off social and economic issues and onto things like the Iraq War or my foreign policy in general, I tend to clam up. It's just that I'm unsure of how to talk to her about Jewish supremacism without her thinking that I'm an anti-Semite or that I somehow think she is bad, which I don't. Could you please enlighten me, Dr. Duke? Thank you very much and keep up the good work." Well, let me tell you something. Over the last 30 years of my life, I've had probably polite conversations, probably with 1,000 Jews on airplane flights who've come to my speeches and wanted to talk to me and question me and discuss things with me. And I've not met only a small number who've been favorable to me. I've met many Jews who are. Of course, the ones that would talk to me probably would tend to be more favorable than the general Jewish population. And many Jews. I mean, I was on the Hashem Tawali show, in Lafayette, Louisiana, a couple weeks ago. And on the program, they had a Jewish lady by the name of Judy Andreas, and she was very erudite and very honest. And she talked about the anti-Gentile animus that she grew up with in the Jewish community, and she recognized exactly what I was saying. So the way that I am, and when I talk to a Jewish person, I talk just as I'm talking right now to you and to the entire audience in the world at large. I would talk to her the same way. I would say, "Look, I've got a problem with Jewish supremacism. I got a problem with these leading Jewish organizations that, have policies against Jewish intermarriage with Gentiles, but at the same time push for integration and intermarriage between white people and other races. I have a problem with Jewish organizations that push for support of Israel, which is a state that limits immigration sharply, but at the same time, Jewish organizations have pushed, tremendously for immigration into America of non-Europeans to the point where we're liable to become a minority in our own country with the incredible implications of that fact." And by the way, when you talk to your friends, whether liberal or conservative, talk about that fact. I mean, obviously, if this country becomes a majority non-white, the political implications are huge and immense in so many different areas. You just have to take the politics right now, say, of the NAACP, as compared to, say, the politics of the average conservative white American. on gun control or on the criminal justice system or on the welfare system or on affirmative action, all these other topics. And how you spend the budget, whether you have a space program or whether you dump it all into the ghetto. I mean, just on all these topics. And imagine for a moment if they had the political majority of the United States of America. What about the Mexicans who, and so many of them who argue for Reconquista, who have a dream of having a new country in the Southwest? Well, what happens to those whites in that country when they become the vast majority of that area? And the biggest Mexican umbrella group in the United States of America is La Raza Unida, meaning the United Race. And they talk frankly about their people being a race and a people and how that they have this right and that they're going to take away from the gringo what the nation and our people really created. They say it was all theirs to begin with. Well, the Mexicans, you know, the Mexican government, the original Spanish, certainly had part of that land many hundreds of years ago with a very tiny population. And it definitely became Anglo. It became part of the United States of America. And but anyway, the way you talk to this lady is simply to be honest with her, straight with her, because we're not doing anything here that is two-faced. We're not being like those Jewish supremacists. We're not saying one thing to our own people and something else to somebody else. And if she is the decent person that you say she is, she'll understand you. And if she doesn't understand you and doesn't understand your position, then I must tell you that's her problem and not your problem. You have an obligation, perhaps, to try to make yourself as understood as well as possible. And I think my approach here, the way I'm approaching this issue right now with you and the other listeners out there, I think it's the right approach, not only from the standpoint of the Jewish listeners or the third world listeners that we have out there, non-white listeners, but I think it's also the right approach to our people, because I think that we have to convince our own people of what's going on. And I think this approach is an approach which opens the mind and opens the thought process rather than fulfills the stereotypes which are created of our people and which are pursued by the media. You know, the way they obviously, I mean, here some of you right now are listening to David Duke for the first time of your lives. For the first time. Some of you have never heard me before. And I would wager to say that what you're hearing from me today is quite distinct and quite different from what you may have expected by what's been written about me. If you read the ADL site about David Duke, and then you come actually read my own site and what I write and what I say, you're going to find something that doesn't even resemble the other. And I've written millions of words. And if you're very cynical, you might think, well, David Duke is just saying that. You know, that's not saying what's really in his heart. Well, you can go back for 30, 40 years of my life, and if you really want to, I'm not talking about some bogus quotations, like a one-line quotation they put on the ADL site. I'm talking about the reams and reams and reams of material and writings and the book material that I've done and speeches I've made. There's probably 1,000 different audio and video tapes of different presentations I've made, and television shows and radio programs and inner meetings and outer meetings. And you will not get the sense of someone using racial epithets. You will not get the sense of someone filled with hate. You will not get the sense of someone who is being unreasonable or trying to harass people. You will get the sense of an individual who I think who's standing up for his own heritage. You know, the liberals are so quick to be supportive of any freedom fighter, again, if there's some minority somewhere in the world, but if a person is of European descent and he's trying to fight for his people's freedom, his heritage, his way of life, well, let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen, you know, that in my mind is just as heroic as anything that you might see on television or anything you might see in the movies about some fighter down in Central America or Vietnam or wherever, who's standing up and trying to fight for his way of life. And so anyway, ladies and gentlemen, that's about it. I'm going to check one more time on the emails, and we're already over time. I always go over time these days, But it really is amazing what's going on right now in Sweden. And, you know, I tell you, if Sweden wants to embark on an international scandal, if they want to be exposed as to their lack of freedom of speech, imagine that. Laws, specific laws in Sweden against freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of conscience, freedom of inquiry. It seems, you know, too amazing to be true, and I don't think the actual average Swede even understands what's happening in his own country. I don't think the average Swede would tolerate such suppression. It goes against everything that we're even taught, everything that we're taught in every major country about what freedom is. Freedom is supposed to be the idea that all of us can think about any idea that we desire and debate any idea that we desire. There are no heretics in the political process. There's nobody that deserves prison because they have the wrong idea. Now, if somebody goes violent, and by the way, in my speech in Sweden, I specifically talk and address the issue of violence, and I say this is not the answer, and this will not only is it wrong, but it's absolutely counterproductive to our cause. It just fulfills the stereotypes against us, and what we've got to do is not go out and bash heads, but to go and promote, you know, our issues and ideas intelligently, and be examples for our people, you know, and lead our people to a new consensus on these issues, and eventually gain political power and influence for our positions, create our own society within a society, promote our own culture, promote our own heritage, do it properly, not do it hatefully. That's not going to win the day for us. And I also talk finally in the speech, which you can hear in Helsingborg. Go to my website, davidduke.com. You can listen to the whole speech. I talk about the fact that the real motivation that I have and the great motivation that should be in all of our hearts is a motivation of love. I quote from Dostoevsky, and I give you his famous quote where he said, "Only beauty can save us." And I say that, you know, in a sense, it's not beauty in its own sense. It's the love that beauty creates and the ideals it creates. And we have a beautiful people and a beautiful heritage. And when we love our people enough, then maybe we'll show the courage and the ability and the drive and the self-sacrifice and the work that we've got to do to make our people survive and be free. Our heritage and freedom are at stake, ladies and gentlemen, and I hope everyone listening to this who can hear the sound of my voice and hear the strings of their own heart, I hope they understand that not only is this issue one that's true, one that can be shown, that immigration will destroy our heritage and destroy our freedom and everything of value in our societies that we care about. But not only is this true, but it's life. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not just an intellectual argument. It's a question of flesh and blood. These issues are vital to ourselves, our own children, to their children. We are either going to continue to exist and live and thrive, our unique expression of life on this planet, or we will die out. If it is somehow evil for the alleged genocide of Jews during the Second World War, or the alleged ethnic cleansing or genocide alleged of Kosovo, or any of the other allegations of this kind of human behavior, if that is truly evil, then isn't it an evil thought, an evil occurrence, if, you know, our European people and heritage are wiped away, wiped from the face of the earth? And when you consider the tremendous achievements of our people, the art, the literature, the music, the architecture, you know, you just look at the products of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, And look at the works of Michelangelo or Da Vinci. Listen to the music of Beethoven or Wagner. Read the fantastic words of Shakespeare. Read the great governing work of our people, whether it be in the writings of Plato or the magnificent structure, the American Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Magna Carta, the Mayflower Compact. You know, look at the medicine that our people have created around the world, the technology, the fact that for the first time, human beings have stepped off this planet onto another sphere. We've gone to the moon, and we're now even training our eyes to outer space. And we're finding ways to make it so many of the sufferings of our children that we had in generations past from other disease and other problems can now be solved by the miracles of medicine, in many ways wrought primarily by our own people. This is a great people, ladies and gentlemen, a beautiful people. Think of the songs and the music and the heritage that our people created, the art forms. When you go to the theater, the movie, think the movies, think about the fact that our people invented the idea that you can make a celluloid movie. Our people invented the telegraph and the telephone and the electric light and the silicon chip by which you can actually hear this program right now anywhere in the world. Our people are a great and creative people. We are not here to oppress or hurt other people, but we certainly have a right to live. We have a right to thrive in our own societies. Sweden has a right to live. The Swedish people have a right to go on. And if that's hate speech, then I guess I'm guilty. If I say that our people have a right to live, if that's supposedly hate, then I'm guilty. But I will continue to stand up and tell the truth the best I know how to do it. And I'm just asking you to join with me in spreading that truth. Because this cause will win, it will succeed, or it will fail. You know, by not just what I do, but by what you do. That's it today, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be with you tomorrow. Until then, God bless and take care.
This has been David Duke for our heritage and our freedom.